If you're not much of a wine drinker, but you want to pick up some wine for a party or other occasion, the array of choices in the wine section of the store can be dizzying. Even if you're set on red versus white or white over red, all the choices within those grand categories can blur the eyes. In fact, even if you pick a kind of wine to seek out, say Chardonnay, there could be dozens of brands and vintages. Our guest this hour gives some lessons in how to be good wine drinkers, wine consumers. Marissa Ross is the author of Wine All the Time, The Casual Guide to Confident Drinking. Marissa is the official wine columnist for Bon Appetit magazine. Her column is called Unfiltered and appears in the print edition. Her blog is also called Wine All the Time, and it's won her a couple of awards. Marissa Ross, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
There's another line in your bio I want to explore, that you're the go-to wine expert for man repeller. What is that?
Yes. So Man Repeller is a fashion website. It's pretty awesome. The woman that started it, her name is Leandra Medine, and she started this website after her fashion choices got her called a man repeller. And it's a very successful website. They have like a million followers and, you know, like literally a million on Instagram and stuff like that. So they're a fun site that I get to write for every once in a while. So,
well, yeah, there's a lot of fun you have with wine. We had our choice. This is the way in which you're helping us be good consumers. We had several choices of pose of you drinking wine straight from the bottle to choose from. We had some reds. We had some whites. Yeah.
Yep, that's usually how it goes. It's like, oh no, what picture of me chugging wine to use? Who knows? There's just so many. So I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I had to put you in such a tough position.
No, it's okay. It was a good lesson in how to begin to make choices about reds versus whites and stuff like that. So you don't actually drink wine like that, though, do you?
They do. It is called the Ross test. So, I mean, it does. All wines that I drink do get subjected to it, but I don't drink the entire. I think there's a common misconception that I like just drink wine out of the bottle, like instead of a glass, like all day or something, which is not true. I just test it out of the bottle because sometimes, you know, maybe you've had a good day, maybe you've had a bad day, maybe you just don't have any clean glasses. You know, sometimes you need to know if a wine is good out of the bottle or not, because not all of them are. Some of them are just better in a glass. And hey, I just want to give the people the information they need when it comes to wine. So,
absolutely, it's about being consumer oriented. Yeah. So,
exactly.
This is not a career path you had in mind, it seems. How did you end up becoming the quasi wine expert in a couple of different venues?
Yeah, it's been a wild ride. I'm from California. I'm from outside of Los Angeles, and I moved to LA 10 years ago to pursue comedy writing and performing. And I was doing that, and you know, doing the whole LA thing, and. But I had this hobby of coming home and drinking wine and writing about it, and I started a website called Wine All the Time, and I just started documenting all these wines that I was drinking and writing about them, and not really writing about them. No one read it. It literally, like, only like 14 people a month maybe went there, and those 14 hits might have been myself, like, who knows. So no one read it. It was just something I really enjoyed doing, and I did it for a long time, and then it got discovered by Grub Street, which is a website New York Magazine does about food. And I didn't really think anything of it. I was like, okay, whatever, like, it doesn't really matter. And then it sort of just, like, mushroomed from there. Like, it blew up. Like, I now wine's my whole life. It's my career, and I couldn't be happier. It all really worked out.
It truly did. You promised to reveal some secrets in the book, and I want to ask for one up front. How you stopped hating Chardonnay.
Oh, yeah. So I used to hate Chardonnay, like hate it. In fact, there's definitely videos of me on the internet somewhere, me being like, I will never be seen drinking Chardonnay, like screw Chardonnay. I stopped hating Chardonnay when I realized that Chardonnay was not at fault for what I hated it for. I just hadn't understood the difference between different fermentations. What I actually hated was oak fermentation, and when they over-oak wines, and they're just like those big, big oaky wines, I just didn't know that that's just not what that grape tasted like. I just thought that that's what it tasted like. And when I learned, oh, there's actually like steel tank fermentation, you know, that actually makes Chardonnay taste very different. Or, you know, concrete egg fermentations that also make it taste different. And then there's oak, which makes it taste oaky. I learned that it's not the grape, you know, it's the role of the winemaker that actually makes the you know, a lot of the choices of how a wine tastes. And it's about, you know, I found personally, you know, it's easier for me to decipher what I do and don't like when you know more about how wine is made than just being like, I don't like something and writing it off forever.
So you're actually applying some, you applied some science here then. It's like, this is why I don't like this, is what you can get to now.
Yeah, exactly, which I think is good because, I mean, the more you know, just like how it's important to know more of what you do like, you know, knowing what you don't like also helps you make better buying decisions, and really that's a part of it too. You know, wine, you don't want to spend $10, $15, you know, however much money you're spending, like $50, on something that you're not going to end up liking, and because then it just feels like you're wasting your money and you're wasting your time. So it's about teaching people to be a little more discerning about wine and learning more about it.
Now, when I saw a disclaimer facing page 7, I thought this was going to be something about drinking responsibly, but instead it's a disclaimer about it's a warning to sommeliers.
Yeah.
What are you trying to say here?
Well, I do have critics. I mean, I know what people say about me. I hear it, you know, and it's also just about the disclaimer is that, hey, like, if you're going to be a jerk about wine, like, this probably isn't for you. And if you're a sommelier, you're going to know probably everything that's in this book, but you might still find it funny and really enjoyable. But, like, I know that you know all of this because you're a sommelier. Like, that's fine, and that's great. And, like, congratulations. Like, that's a huge deal. Being a sommelier is an incredible accomplishment. But I also don't need you, like, hating me for you know, the fact that you knew everything in the book. So I just wanted to have that up front because you just don't know with sommeliers.
That is indeed where it is, up front, right in front of a glossary, in fact. So there's a glossary in the front of the book, so you can get to know the terms before you learn some of the processes as well. A lot in the book, and a lot of it all fun. It's called Wine All the Time. It's the work of Marissa Ross. We'll come back and talk more with Marissa and take phone calls and emails from you on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Even if you never drink a drop of wine, you can still have some fun reading Marissa Ross's book called Wine All the Time, The Casual Guide to Confident Drinking. Casual because she's not coming at this like a sommelier or somebody who has extensive experience, but she has learned a lot over the years and shares that with us in the book Wine All the Time, which is also the name of her blog, which predates the book. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Share some stories about wine and searches for good ones or discoveries of bad ones. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So back to the formation of what became your career. Age 22, not making much money. What kind of wine could you afford, Marissa?
Oh man, I was definitely drinking two-buck Chuck. I mean, it was a rough start. I will say that. I definitely drank mostly grocery store wines under $10 for a good couple of years. I was so broke when I moved to Los Angeles, though, that there wasn't. It was like, that's fine. $3 for a bottle of wine is a steal. This is great news. But yeah, it was a rough start. But I think that's good because it's given me more appreciation for the wines I drink now, and also I think gives me a insight into what many other consumers kind of go through when it comes to wine and how they probably start out too.
So how did you make the decision on what was to be your moving up wine?
I really liked wine, and I was like, you know what, if I like $2 wine, I'll probably like $5 wine. Let's give it a shot. And then when I was like, oh, this is actually a lot better. And I was like, wow, it's crazy that like $3 actually makes a difference. I'm like, I wonder, it must be if I buy a $10 bottle of wine, then I'm going to like it. And then I did, and I was like, oh, wow, this really is better. And it just kept kind of going. And now here I am. I mean, I don't spend a ton of money still on wine. I think that people think that I probably spend a lot more than I do, but most of the bottles that I drink are all, you know, under $40 generally. So still fairly reasonable in terms of, like, wine connoisseurship.
So the intro where I talked about if you're not a wine drinker and you go try to pick up some wine, that's basically me. So you know, there are going to be some influences from labels and things like that. It sounds like you fell for the rooster.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did. I did get that. Well, you know what? It just seemed like the least crappy one from the liquor store down the street from my house. I was like, this seems like it's all right. All the other bottles were like covered in dust, you know. And I was like, oof, if these are covered in dust, they must not be very good. So that yeah, I definitely did do the fell for the rooster at first. That happened.
So how different is, for example, the $5 Rex Goliath Pinot Noir from what you had been drinking?
I mean, well, now looking back, they weren't that different. They seemed like they were a big difference then. Now, I mean, I haven't drank it in years. But it tasted more like what I thought wine should taste like, if that makes sense. Like the wine, the way that the way the world, you know, perceives wine or is, you know, you perceive it. I was like, oh, this tastes, I understand a little bit about like what they mean when they say red fruit, I guess. This kind of tastes like red fruit, whereas the other stuff just tastes like alcohol. You know, like, it's like, what are you supposed to like pick out when it just like tastes like bland? I don't even know. It's just gross. But you don't even know that it's gross when you first start drinking it. That's what sucks, is like you just don't realize it. You're like, oh, this isn't bad. Wine's cool. Like, let's do this. And then you move on and you're like, wow, that stuff was really bad.
It is kind of
no wonder it was $2.
Yeah, I get that sense of the backward look where you realize later on, I was like, oh, that stuff really isn't that good, is it?
No, yeah, it's not. It doesn't taste that good, nor is it that good for you, like the consumer or the earth either. It's not good stuff. So, yeah, I don't really drink it anymore. Thank goodness.
Yeah, we'll get into the earth and health and all that later on. I want to ask about, this is where some of the real fun in the book is, and your descriptions of the things that you got from wines. And I get some mixed messages from your description of Sauvignon Blanc, the first Sauvignon Blanc you tried as an adult. You talked about how it felt like it put the wind in your hair, but it had a taste like a clean kitty litter box.
Yep. Yeah. Well, but, you know, like, well, actually, I revisited all the wines to write that portion of the book. So, actually, that portion of the book was actually, like, a 30-minute one-woman comedy show I did, like, 3 years ago. And I actually poured all those wines and did it on stage and, like, tried them. And that's what it tasted like to me. It was like a cat litter box. So,
oh,
it was,
wow.
Like, but a clean one. But a clean one. Still not the best, but at least it wasn't dirty.
Marissa Ross is our guest on The Exchange. Her book is called Wine All the Time, The Casual Guide to Confident Drinking. So let's get a little more serious here. Drawing upon your memory and your senses is the foundation of tasting, enjoying, and learning about wine. That's really profound, drawing upon your memory and your senses. So let's talk about it separately, your memory first, and what you get from your memory when you drink wine.
Yeah, I think that works in two ways. One, like, when I say that, I'm talking about, one, like, your memory of, like, other wines you've drank, but also, two, like, just your memory of life and what you've experienced. And for me, like, what I love so much about writing about wine and why I still love writing about it is that every bottle kind of takes me somewhere. It reminds me of something. It conjures something inside of me from long, you know, maybe not long ago, maybe long ago. Just reminds me of something. Like, I'll open a bottle and it'll remind me of the ocean breezes by my grandmother's house from when I was a kid, you know, and sort of just calling upon those things that I loved in my life and that are good, happy memories, and or maybe not so happy memories, and drawing upon those to make correlations between the wine and, you know, tasting it.
So it is more than tasting, though. I mean, when you talk about the senses, you're using more than just the sense of taste with a wine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for me, I think a wine can taste like, I mean, and also, too, you know, when you're tasting wine, like, a lot of it is, you know, how it smells. That's where, you know, your taste really is half of that. But, you know, to me, like, I taste a wine and I often relate it to music or, you know, a certain feeling of, you know, like, or like a couch cushion or whatever it is that it just reminds me of other senses. It's not just taste. It can be anything that it reminds you of.
It seems like you've developed quite a sense of adventure about wine over the years. Do you have the same sense of adventure about food, I wonder?
I do. I try to be adventurous about food. I'm a bit of a texture person, which sometimes is troublesome, but I always try everything at least once, twice, three times. If I don't like it after the third time, I probably won't try it again. Like I'm not a big fan of like bone marrow.
Uh-huh.
Oof, but like I can't deal with bone marrow, and I can't deal with sea urchin. Like those are two things that I'm like so grossed out by. But I always will at least give it a bite and at least go for it. So I'm pretty adventurous when it comes to those things. Except like I was in Spain last year and they brought out like just a pig's head, and I was like, I can't do it. I'm never eating meat again. That's not true. I still eat meat, but holy moly, I was like, ah. So sometimes it's a little bit harder with food.
What was it called, bone marrow in the book? Was it meat jelly?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. I'm like, why does anyone want to eat something that you would describe as meat jelly? That is so gross. Like, ugh. But people love it. People love it. My husband loves it. So
wow.
I'm like, you got it. It's all you, babe. Congratulations. You just ordered yourself a plate of bone marrow.
You point out that it's not so much a sense of adventure for some people, but it's almost a scientific approach that they take to wine. And you point out that you have a rather profound hatred of math. But do you see a value in taking a scientific approach to wine and its enjoyment?
Sure. I mean, well, yes and no. I think that there's a reason to be scientific about wines. You know, when we're talking about how it's made and, like, flaws and things like that. But I think overall, like, when it comes to enjoyment, I really do believe that wine is completely subjective. You know, like, there's a good chance that a wine that I love, like, you'll hate and vice versa. And I just don't think that it's fair to quantify them in that way. Personally, a lot of people do, and that's awesome. That's and that helps some people. Just for me personally, and I get flack for this, that I don't write negative reviews, for example. And that's why I don't write negative reviews. I just don't write about wines I don't like, because I don't want to taint someone else's experience. Like if it's a wine that maybe someone perhaps would love, like if I say that it's trash, you know, I don't want that to influence someone else's experience and possible enjoyment.
Huh, okay. There is obviously some science we can't avoid, as you point out in the book. What is the bitter receptor?
Yeah, so some of us have this bitter receptor where we're really sensitive to bitterness, and I think it's in the same. It's like the same vein as like certain people. You know how like cilantro tastes like soap to certain people. It's sort of that same thing where like there's just certain people have this bitter receptor that makes them extra sensitive to it, and so you're just not gonna like some stuff, and that's okay. Like it's okay not to like stuff.
So you could then have a wine that would make some sommeliers weep for joy, but other people just wouldn't like it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true anyways, with or without. You know, I'm sure that there's a lot of wines that I love that like my sommelier friends who are like master sommeliers and make so much fun of me for loving, and they hate them. And same thing, like they'll be like, oh, you have to try this Bordeaux, and I'm like, ugh, this is so boring. And they're like, what? This is like the best Bordeaux ever, and I'm like, no. You know, it's just, I think it's just, you know, personal taste. I personally really love really acidic things. Like I love like sour and, salt. Like those are my two favorite sensations, and taste. So I love wines that kind of mimic that. Whereas like other people want wines that are, you know, jammier or bigger and or maybe a bit sweeter. So it all comes back to just what you like.
We are talking to Marissa Ross about her book, Wine All the Time. Her blog is called the same thing, too. The book is subtitled The Casual Guide to Confident Drinking. It's a real fun romp, essentially, through she actually gets into a fair amount of science in here and a pretty good-sized glossary. So it's not total sommelier approach, but it's from somebody who's learned a lot about wine and didn't necessarily intend to in the first place. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Talk about your own wines, your own experiences with trying to pick out a good wine, maybe some bad experiences as well. Let's not talk about decorating bathrooms or anything like that. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. I noticed that you said you started out buying two-buck Chuck. Myself, I buy all my wine, and I do buy wine with some regularity when it's available at a dollar store here in Reading.
Wow.
The corporation has 62 stores in the state of California that have liquor licenses, and they buy wines from distributors that have gone bankrupt.
And
and
how's the quality? I mean,
it varies. Some of it make good polish material, but some of it is actually drinkable. You know, I've never had any that I couldn't put down, you know. But one time we got some from a local winery, right? It was Zinfandel, made in the old style with the stems and leaves in the bottle. And I, a couple years later, ran into the guy who owned the winery and told him about it. He said, that was never supposed to happen. The distributor should have called us, and we would have bought it back from him. Yeah, he was just furious. I still have a couple bottles of that. I don't know. You have to filter it, you know, to get all the gunk out of it. But, you know, it's kind of interesting that somebody would actually go to the trouble of making it in that style.
Right.
Oh. But, you know, it's just amazing what happens, you know, in the business. I've had wines from all over the world, with the exception of Oregon. I've never gotten any wine from Oregon there.
Really?
What?
Oh, at the dollar store, you mean.
South Africa, Argentina, Spain, France, Australia. You know, it's just amazing.
Wow, coming to a dollar store near you. Thanks for the story, Mark. Appreciate that. So, so Marissa, you have a new venue to go check out for places to pick up wine.
I know, apparently. I'm like, oh, my gosh, I had no idea that was a thing. Like, I mean, at least not at that price. I mean, that's lower than I knew. That's incredible.
Now, I know you said you don't give bad reviews of wine, but when you mentioned Zinfandel, it reminded me that you were a little hard on Zinfandel in the book.
Yeah, I'm a little hard on the I don't like the way that they started making Zinfandel in the 90s when they started like pumping up the alcohol by volume to, you know, 15-16%. You know, that's just egregious. Like, Zinfandel is a very pretty wine when it's made in lower alcohol contents and like not made so ripe. I think that those wines kind of gave California a bad name in some ways. But I'm happy because now California is starting to go back to making Zinfandel more like they did in the 70s and stuff, where it's a little bit of a lighter style and not such high alcohol by volume.
Science aside, let's talk about some social aspects of wine and wine enjoyment. I mean, did you and do you find some peer pressure? You were just talking about the sommeliers who were talking about this is a great Bordeaux. I mean, so is there a fair amount of that? It's like, come on, it's great. You got to like it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, well, the thing about wine people is that we're all really passionate about what we like. You know, the reason that we're in the business is probably because, you know, we really, really love wine. And so there is a thing where you're like, what? And I try not to do this to people around me because I know how annoying it is. But it's sometimes hard not to be like, what do you mean you don't love this? Like, this is my favorite wine. And you're like, well, it's all right. Like, now more for me, I guess. It's all right. Like, I recently took a wine over to my friend's house, and I was so excited. I'd had this bottle, and I'd been saving this second one I had, and I was like, all right, I'm going to save this for something special. And I was like, oh, my gosh, you guys, I got this really rare wine from the Czech Republic. It's incredible. Like, it's an unfiltered, like, Gruner Veltliner. Like, it's unlike anything you've ever drank. And everyone had a sip, and they were like, yeah, that's cool. It's all right. And it took everything in me not to be like, what? Like, what are you talking about? And I just had to like be like, all right, well, you know. And they knew I was upset. They make fun of me about it, or they've been making fun of me about it for a couple weeks now, like how upset I was over this Gruner Veltliner. And I thought I was like really hiding my emotion, but apparently I wasn't.
Good for you for trying anyway. Trying to spare some people.
I try.
Feelings, yeah.
I, you know, I'm only human, so.
So, Marissa, I mean, obviously people would probably think about applying the term to you, but you're not crazy about the term wine snob, I understand.
No, I'm not. I do think, I'm just not into that at all. I don't think that anyone should be. I mean, it's hard because I think that, you know, I probably would be classified as a wine snob in a lot of ways, but I try really hard not to be because I think that term is isolating and it makes, you know, it's a really negative thing. And I try really hard to make wine as inclusive as possible and, like, make sure that wine is more of a conversation rather than me being like, this is what it is, and you have to believe me, and you have to drink this Gruner Veltliner and love it. Like, that's not what I want to do. So I try to stay away from the term wine snob.
Fair enough. So how much did you know about making wine before you got a little further into appreciating wine?
I didn't know that much about it when I first started drinking it, but then over the years, I started, like, visiting wineries, and I became friends with some winemakers, and I started just, you know, asking them a ton of questions and researching it, and especially when the whole thing happened with that Chardonnay that we were talking about earlier, how I figured out that the fermentation was what I didn't like, and that was what the problem was. When that happened, that, like, clicked where I was like, oh, I need to learn more about winemaking. And understand what the processes are behind these, because that's what's influencing the flavor more so than the actual grape.
All right. See, I see it. So, okay. So you figured out this is a good Chardonnay. I didn't think Chardonnay could be good. And then that got you on the trail of finding out how it gets there. We have an email here from Jeff in Ashland who says that understanding basic bottle styles and their origins can help a novice quickly find what they like. Would you explain how Bordeaux, Burgundy, and Hauk bottles shape origins are stylistically generally adhered to by winemakers around the world?
Oh, wow. That's an intense question.
It is.
No, that's fine. I think that that's totally true. I mostly work in, like, the natural wine world, and they don't really abide by those bottle shapes as often. So I can't, like, define right now, personally, like, each individual one. But, you know, if you love Chianti, for example, like, in a Chianti Fiasco bottle, like, you know that that will always be in, like, this one type of bottle that has, like, a straw basket around it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Or, which actually, like, went out of style, but it's coming back. Like, watch out. Fiasco bottles are coming back. I've been seeing them, and I'm like, what is happening? But, yeah, absolutely. I think that the wine, if you learn about bottle styles, like, if you learn about a Burgundy style versus, like, a Riesling bottle, like, a Burgundy bottle is a much rounder shape than, like, a Riesling bottle, which is, like, very tall. Or like a Gruner Veltliner from, you know, Germany.
Okay, we'll pick it up on the other side of a break. Back with Marissa Ross in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're having a fun romp through the wine section of the grocery store with Marissa Ross, metaphorically, of course. She is the author of a blog and now a book by the same name called Wine All the Time, The Casual Guide to Confident Drinking. It really is casual. She comes at this from something other than a sommelier's perspective, where she started just wanting to understand a little more about why a $5 wine was better than a $2 wine, what makes a $10 wine better than a $5 wine, and so forth. And so it's a really useful guide with a lot of humor in it because she is a comedy writer as well. And you can join us on The Exchange as we talk about wine and some of the fun and discovering things about it. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So you didn't know much about wine making when you started the journey. I mean, has it been a real, I mean, I imagine you're just awash in terms and all the different variables that can go into the making of any wine now.
Yeah, it's really, it's overwhelming at times. I mean, it's all overwhelming. I mean, wine itself is like such a crazy, expansive subject. Like, for example, the email that we just got about different bottles, right? Like, that's something that is really great for recognizing different regions. And when you know, like, that this particular bottle comes from this region, you know, that's super helpful. But also, like, that's not even something that I got into in the book, you know, because it's so overwhelming how much there is about wine. It's incredible. And when it comes to winemaking, you know, there are just, like, new crazy styles of winemaking that are happening all the time, or, like, different fermentations and blends and new techniques that winemakers are using. And so it's great because you're constantly just exploring, and as long as you're curious, you can continue learning so much all the time. Although it is overwhelming and hard to, like, keep it all in your brain all times as well.
I've been around the process a few times, Marissa. Is it very user intensive? I mean, do the winemakers have to intervene a lot, or is a lot of the wine fermentation process allowed to happen naturally?
It depends on what kind, you know, it really depends on the winemaker, or I guess in larger terms, the company that's doing it. You know, I have a chapter in the book that's, you know, about the differences between commercial and natural wines. Natural wines can totally ferment on their own and do their thing and with very little intervention. Or, you know, there's some wines that need a lot of intervention because maybe the grapes are really bad, or, you know, there's a lot of other additives in the, you know, like a lot of things that are happening in the vineyard that are making the wines taste a certain way, so they have to add things to it to make it taste more like wine as we see it. So it just depends, really.
Let us take a call. Here's John in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Marissa Ross.
Yes, had a question for you, Marissa. Along with your conversation here, I just started fermenting some cherry wine. Picked them last weekend. And before I could get the yeast that I purchased for fermentation, it's st- started fermenting on its own, and I was very concerned that, oh, I've got bad yeast, and it's going to create a terrible wine. And what are your thoughts about that?
Oh, I think it's amazing that your wine started doing it all on its own. Like, that's basically what, like, natural winemakers do, is they, you know, they let the wild yeast that's already occurring in their environment, you know, take over. So I think that that's way better. I mean, I can't say how your cherry wine is going to turn out, but I think that's so cool and awesome, and I love that. I hope that it turns out amazing, and then that way you don't ever have to do the other yeasts, and it'll make, you know, awesome cherry wine. And I want to try it. I'm like, this is so cool.
Yeah, thanks for the story, John. Appreciate that. So now we've turned the corner and started talking about natural wine. I mean, I guess some of us might have thought that, well, isn't most of it natural? But what is going on in the wines that you're not calling natural that you want us to be aware of?
Yeah, so it's crazy because people don't really think about wine as an agricultural product. I think because of American drinking culture is kind of the issue with that, you know, like we have to stave off. We're told that we're not allowed to drink until we're 21, and then you release us into the, you know, into college, and you know, and people binge drink, and so it develops like a very unhealthy relationship to alcohol. I think in the sense that you're not really, it becomes a means to an end. Like you want to just get drunk, and you're not really thinking about it. So people don't think about wine as an agricultural product, and you got to think about, you know, you have to think about food or wine like you think about food. Like if you care about where your kale comes from, you got to care about where your wine comes from, because those grapes, you know, in commercial wines, those really cheap wines, those wines are being made in the same way that like a Big Mac is being made. Like they're being like chemically constructed, you know, and there's a lot of pesticides and herbicides and synthetic fertilizers and chemicals that are being used in the vineyard that are harmful to the earth. And obviously we don't have very many long-term studies on how those affect us as people. I do know that a lot of the chemicals they have to use in the vineyard are very dangerous to the people that have to administer them. And then in turn, because of that, they have to add a lot of chemicals to the wine. So there's a lot of additives and you know, different fining agents and things like that to quote-unquote make it unlike wine. And people don't know that they're drinking this stuff that has a lot of things in it that aren't necessarily very good for you. It's sort of like when people say, oh, I can't drink red wine, it gives me the worst hangovers. Like, oh, it's the sulfites. It's not either one of those things, really. It's probably a lot of the chemicals and additives that the company doesn't even have to tell you are in the wine that you're consuming. So natural wines are, it's an unregulated term, which makes it a very ambiguous kind of weird thing, but natural wines are wines that are made without any intervention in the vineyard, or little intervention in the vineyard. Actually, none in the vineyard, just kidding. no intervention in the vineyard, and little to no intervention in the cellar. So natural wines generally have nothing added except maybe a small amount of sulfur, sometimes, not always. But it's just nothing added, nothing taken away. Wine, just like the glass collar and how his wine started fermenting on its own, and just like that, no added yeast, nothing.
So I think I can understand some of the terms in this section. Organic seems pretty clear. Sustainable seems pretty clear. Biodynamic. What's a biodynamic wine?
So biodynamics is a it's a farming philosophy from this philosopher Rudolf Steiner, and he believed that farming and it should be not only good for the land, it should be like a spiritual thing as well as an agricultural thing. So it's sort of, I hate to use this word, but it's sort of like pagany, because like you basically have to do, you know, you're planting based on the moon cycles, and you're like planting goat horns like filled with a certain type of manure and like spraying valerian root and stuff. And it's to make sure that the vineyard itself is a full ecosystem, and whatever you're taking from the earth to put into your, you know, whatever nutrients are coming into your vines, you need to replace those. So it's about that, but it has this whole spiritual aspect on it as well.
I like
it's
the use
very
of,
strict.
Yeah, I like the use of the term pagan in there. That makes it more fun.
It is kind of paganish. It's like it's very interesting. I mean, I have a lot of respect for people that can do it because it's very, very strict, like code of conduct. There's like 9 very specific steps you have to take, and it's serious business, despite being kind of witchy.
Let's take another call. Here's Russell in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Marissa Ross, the author of Wine All the Time.
Good morning, Jeffrey and Marissa.
Hi.
Hi.
Quite a few years ago, 40 or so, in California, Napa Valley, or San Rafael, actually, I met a man who's involved in the wine industry who proclaimed that year in the wine tasting competition in the state of California, the winner was a Mogan David that had not a bit of grape in it.
Really?
I've never checked this out, but listening to you guys talking this morning, I remembered it and thought I would ask.
All right, let's see if Marissa's got something about that. Thanks, Russell.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say why that happened, but I mean, as someone that's judged in those competitions, I'm not surprised. I mean, those really big competitions are generally these winemakers that have enough money to put their wine in the competition. So it's not necessarily like, so there's a very good chance that, yeah, that might have tasted best, or there's also a really good chance that that wine got picked because of other economic reasons. I know that at one of the competitions I judged at, like, I was sitting at a table with an oak barrel producer, like someone that sells oak barrels.
Mm-hmm.
So every wine that had oak in it, she rated extremely high because it was beneficial to her business, you know? So who's to say if it actually tasted better or not? That's why I kind of don't love, like, the competitions and the rating systems and things like that, because I don't trust them.
Well, it's very subjective, as you pointed out earlier. I mean, and a lot of, you know, based on your palate and what hits it a certain way.
Absolutely. And also, too, like, the fact that, like, that wine, you know, I haven't heard that particular story, but I'm not at all surprised because, one, I mean, they've been doing that stuff for years, not even in, you know, around the world. Like, there was wines in Italy that they found out, you know, were made with, like, ox blood in them and, like, just horrible, horrible things and no grapes. But those wines are they're chemically made to taste like wine. So maybe the people really did like them, you know, and but that's scary to me. You know, people don't even know if you don't know what you're drinking, that's terrifying.
Which I should point out that there's a fair number of words in the book we can't say on the radio, but in this part of the book about the gnarly stuff in wine, they're actually pretty thick. You really care about this.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I try not to be on a soapbox about it. I try not to be preachy about it. I think it's important for me. I believe in, like, leading by taste and then following with education and philosophy. So it's like if you like these wines, then great. I can teach you about maybe why you like them more or why you feel better drinking them. I'm very passionate about it, but I try not to, you know, because I don't think wine's already hard enough to get into. Like, I don't need to be coming at people being like with all these like crazy words or making them feel like they don't know about wine because it's not natural or not biodynamic or not this or that. And so I really, really care about it. It's probably what I care about the most. But I know that it's going to be, you know, it's a slow process to get everyone up to speed and not isolate anyone and make everyone feel good about things, you know?
That's very inclusive of you. Let's take another call. It looks like Chris and Wairika got inspired by the call about cherry wine. Welcome, Chris.
Yeah, I just wanted to relate. I met this guy in Eureka who had made several different types of fruit wines, and he said that basically, other than grapes, his favorite was using kiwis, and he said,
I was going to say, kiwi!
Yeah, he said, I mean, it sounded like he experimented with quite a few different fruits, and he said, if you can go, you know, get some, like, overripe kiwis, you know, on a deal or something at the market late in the season or something, pick them up, and yeah, it makes a great wine.
Oh, that sounds great, Chris. Pick it up from
I've had kiwi wine, and it's so good. That's a true story. It's delicious.
So are there other wines that you've had that are not made from grapes that you might have, like, sipped reluctantly but found you liked?
I have not. I have not yet. The kiwi wine was given to me as a gift from my friend that went to New Zealand, and he was like, I got this kiwi wine, and it was so good, I had to bring it back for you. And I was like, oh, great. I'm going to have to tell Josh this is trash, and, like, why did you bring this for me? God damn it. Oh, excuse me. But it was great, and I was, like, really, really surprised by how delicious it was. I think the kiwis in a lot of ways are like grapes, so it kind of makes sense to me, like, in terms of the texture and the juiciness of them. But I haven't tried much other ones. But maybe I'll have to, you know, now if I get a hold of this cherry wine, this very rare Oregon cherry wine that I just found out about.
But don't look at the dollar store, as we heard from Mark.
Yeah.
For anything for
who knows that maybe the dollar stores are like ripe with, you know, cherry wine. I just haven't been looking. Maybe
could be. Before we go, can you give us just the in the glass, from the bottle to the glass, what we should be sniffing for, looking for, tasting for?
Yeah. So I mean, I guess that's hard to say. I mean. I don't think there's anything in particular you should or shouldn't be looking for. I think what's most important about wine tasting is just being present with it. You know, so often in today's world, we are like on our phones or like connected to our laptops or we're having anxiety about tomorrow or today or yesterday, and we're not really present with it. You know, like we're not really thinking about what you're drinking. So just the most important thing is to like really look at your wine, really smell your wine, and really taste your wine. And if you want to really taste it, a good tip is to chew it. You will get a whole different view of it. It's crazy.
I noticed the chewing part in there, and so I'm glad you left us with that. But it's a fun book. It's called Wine All the Time, The Casual Guide to Confident Drinking. You can be both casual and confident at the same time. Marissa Ross, the author of that, and the blog by the same name, Wine All the Time. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.